You might see a stack of them at the bookstore. You'd notice the familiar cover, a cozy green room with striped curtains and a fire glowing in the fireplace. Outside, a full moon in a starry sky. But look closer. Hey, that painting over the fireplace shows an oil derrick with stealth bombers flying around it. That's a ballot box burning in the fireplace. It says Florida 2000. And is that a tiny microphone sneaking around the side of the fireplace? It is. Welcome to the dark world of Goodnight Bush, an unauthorized parody, it says so right on the cover, of the beloved children's classic Goodnight Moon. It's sure to offend on any number of levels and takes a caustic view of the last 8 years. Goodnight Bush is the creation of web writer and producer Eric Origen and Gan Galan, an artist and grassroots activist. Galan begins by describing the first page.
In it, instead of a bunny rabbit, we see a childlike bush tucked safely away in the confines of his own room. And he's surrounded by all these toys, which now represent different facets of the Bush administration's legacy.
And Eric Origen, this young childlike President Bush is wearing a flight suit?
Yes, Bush is wearing his flight suit underoos. And he moves very slightly from color panel to color panel. But just like in the original, between color panels, you have these black and white spot illustrations of things that have been broken or destroyed. We're sort of left to wonder what happened between one color panel and the next.
Why don't you read the first few pages of the book? Eric, do you want to start?
Sure. In the Situation Room, there was a toy world and a flight costume and a picture of
a refinery plume, and there were war profiteers giving three cheers, a nation great, a church, and a state.
A pair of towers and a balance of powers, a grand old party to war in a rush, and a quiet Dick Cheney whispering hush. Good night, room.
And Eric, why don't you jump ahead to the last few pages of the book?
Good night, grand old party. Good night, war in a rush. And good night to Dick Cheney, whispering, hush. Good night, earth. Good night, air. Good night, failures everywhere. Everyone has vacated the room. Cheney's gone, and Bush is left alone with his nuclear phone off the hook, our Federal Reserve piggy bank broken, and we have the moon and the stars, you know, shining bright outside the window, offering this kind of larger perspective on all of this.
It's always fun when you're reading Goodnight Moon with a child to look for the little mouse that is in a different place on every color page. He's scampering around the room. And in your book, Goodnight Bush, it's not a mouse. It's a little figure of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, we like to call him Mousama bin Laden. Throughout the book, we see him kind of roaming freely throughout the room, apparently unconcerned with being captured.
I wonder whether the lawyers at your publisher were busy for weeks or months trying to figure out whether that there were issues about fair use and whether you could actually publish a parody that is so similar in so many ways to the original book.
It was actually fairly straightforward. I mean, the publisher felt that we were definitely in safe territory, and they had done a similar book in the past called Yiddish with Dick and Jane that was, of course, a parody of Dick and Jane. So based on their experience with that, we went forward with it.
So many people hold Goodnight Moon so dear to their hearts, and I think I would count myself among that number. And looking at this book, people will say, you know, this is a sacrilege. You've taken a favorite children's iconic book and turned it into something really dark and completely other than what it was.
Well, the book obviously isn't for children. At the same time, it lets us look at the past 8 years through the eyes of a child. And it lets us see how far Bush's reality is from the reality anyone would want for their children.
How much did you think about how offensive some of this might be? I mean, for example, there's a page where there are two towers made out of building blocks, child's toys, and an airplane has knocked them down. And it says, "Good night, towers," to represent the World Trade Center towers. You know, you can look at that and say, that's horrifying, and that's not, you know, appropriate in this book if you're talking necessarily about the Bush administration legacy.
Well, everything in the book is rendered with this kind of naked simplicity. And hopefully that also implies a respect as well as some sensitivity around it.
Where is the sensitivity that you see in that image?
If I may, I think people really understand, you know, there's a real poignancy to many of those images, and that's, you know, the way it was intended, because, you know, the last 8 years have been full of all these tragic incidents, and it's really that combination of kind of flippant absurdity that we sometimes seen from the president, and that's in the book, but at the same time, you know, a real seriousness about what it is that we've lost.
Gan Golan and Eric Origen are the creators of the unauthorized parody Goodnight Bush. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're ready for summer vacation. The bags are packed. The airplane tickets are in hand. The neighbor said he'd water your lawn. There's just one nagging question. What book should you take? Librarian Nancy Pearl is here with some answers. They're what she calls great airplane reads. And this first book that I'm holding up actually has a man holding a suitcase. It's called The Arrival by Sean Tan. Am I saying the name correctly?
You are. And this is a fabulous, fabulous book. It's a book without words, and yet it tells a really complicated story. It's a picture book, but it's not intended for young readers. And what it is the story of a man who leaves his homeland to come to a new country. And you get the scenes in just wordless, wonderful, wonderful pictures of everything that happens when he says goodbye to his family. And there's one picture in there, Steve, where his wife and his daughter and he are all holding hands and then letting go. And that's a picture, I think, that just will break your heart. And what Sean Tan does in that book so wonderfully is really universalize the sense of what it's like to come to a new world.
I suppose we should mention when we say that this is going to a new world, this isn't exactly someone going to New York, but you see the person in the harbor.
Right.
City behind the harbor looks kind of New York-y. Here's somebody in what must be the immigration hall. It looks a little bit like Ellis Island. It's an extraordinarily strange version of New York, but this seems to be where the person is going.
But it's surreal enough so that it both takes a common situation, the immigrant coming to America, and yet at the same time, because it's not quite the America that we know, it just adds that kind of surreal dimension to it.
So the first in our stack about great airplane reads is about someone taking a long journey. And let's pick one of the smaller books here, Robin McKinley, Sunshine. According to the blurb, it's pretty much perfect.
I have rarely met anyone who's read Sunshine who has not loved it. It's the story of a young woman named Ray Seddon, who is driving home one morning from making cinnamon rolls at her stepfather's coffee house when she runs into a group of vampires. It turns out that she is going to be used as bait for this very enigmatic vampire named Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
Constantine overcomes his natural desires to do with her as vampires tend to do, and Ray discovers in herself the means to get them both out of this very sticky situation. And then her troubles really begin.
Oh.
Now, what Robin McKinley does in this book so well is mix the real and the fantastical. When you start the book, for the first 15 pages, there are like clues here or there that this is not the world that we really know, although everything is very familiar. Cinnamon rolls. And then all of a sudden, there's a line that says, but when the voodoo wars happened, and then you think, wait, what world am I in?
So we've got two books in a row here that start with the real world and make it strange.
Three
it
books,
new.
Actually.
Oh, we've got
There's another one.
Which one?
The Thin Place.
The Thin Place.
The Thin
Catherine
Place.
Davis, a novel.
Now, what you want in an airplane book, you want a book that is complex enough that you're drawn into it so you can forget that you're having this elbow war with the person next to you over the armrest and you can overcome your anger at the person in front of you who's tilted his seat back into your lap.
Mm-hmm.
So you want a book that really grabs you and takes you away.
And something that when you're forced to hold it about 4 inches from your face,
yes,
because of that seat, it still reads pretty well. You want
right.
a nice font.
And
nice,
yet you
font.
Don't want something so complex that when it's interrupted by those announcements of putting on your seatbelt, et cetera,
yeah,
that you're going to lose your place and never be able to recapture it. So you don't want plotless wonders. And The Thin Place is one of those mesmerizing, mysterious books that does exactly that. And this is how it begins. There were three girlfriends, and they were walking down a trail that led to a lake, one small and plump, one pretty and medium-sized, one not so pretty and tall. This was in the early years of the 21st century, the unspeakable having happened so many times, everyone was still in shock, still reeling from what they'd seen, what they'd done or failed to do. The dead souls no longer wore gowns. They'd gotten loose, broadcasting their immense soundless cord through the precincts of the living. Mm. So you get this beautiful writing. And you get this mysteriousness, and it's set in a small town near the Canadian border and named Varennes. And Varennes is a thin place. It's a place that is where the border between the real and the inchoate, between the living and the dead, is very permeable.
And should we draw anything from the fact that Catherine Davis, the author, is recorded here as having received a Kafka Prize?
Indeed.
The next book we have here is from Thomas Perry, Metzger's Dog.
The thing that should tell you everything you need to know about that book is that Metzger is a cat. Add to that that it's a thriller, and it's about some urban terrorists who are determined to take down Los Angeles.
Do you mind? I just flipped it open
yes,
at random here and came
do.
To classic Raymond Chandler writing here. Chinese Gordon's body was hunched forward over the steering wheel, his right foot still on the gas pedal, and his teeth clenched as the van knifed into the space between two cars and shot up the harbor freeway. Love it! Love it.
And it's just a lot of fun. It's one of those getting lost in on the airplane books.
Well, let's travel through one more book in the stack.
Okay. One the more. Other thing is just a wonderful picture book, which if you're traveling with a 4 to 7 year old, this is a book that I think that you would really, really like. Now, we always hear the term when we're talking about literary fiction, metafiction, which is basically fiction about fiction. Mm-hmm. But Chester by Melanie Watt is the first meta picture book that I've ever run across. Now, maybe there are others, but I have not found them. So the book opens with Melanie Watt, the author, explaining that she's trying to write and illustrate a book about a mouse, but her cat, Chester, does not care for that idea. He thinks that it's his book and he is in charge of creating it. So there's Melanie trying to write her picture book, and there's Chester with his red magic marker in hand or in paw. Melanie thinks she's gotten the upper hand of Chester because she has a picture of him in a pink tutu. And this is a huge insult to Chester, who believes that his name stands for charming, handsome, envy of mouse, smart, talented, envy of Melanie, really handsome. Chester comes up with his own revenge on Melanie. And I think what is so much fun about this is to get some 4 to 7 year old talking about whose book is it really? Is it Chester's book or is it Melanie's? And who's won that battle between them?
I already know what the kid's going to say to that.
The cat.
No. It's going to say, it's my book.
Oh, that's right.
Nancy Pearl, great to have you come by.
Thank you, Steve.
You can see illustrations from Chester and The Arrival and read excerpts of Nancy Pearl's other book recommendations at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
This week on Book Tour...
In the dying light of an autumn day in 1937, a certain Herr Edvard Juhl, a secret agent, descended from a first-class railway carriage in the city of Warsaw.
We're joined by celebrated spy novelist Alan First, whose meticulously researched books all take place in that gathering of storm clouds that was Europe before World War II.
Above the city, the sky was at war. The last of the sun struck blood-red embers off massed black cloud, while the clear horizon to the west was the color of blue ice.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
Wisconsin and Minnesota are the latest settings for modern-day versions of Shakespeare's Hamlet in novel form. The novels are Undiscovered Country and The Story of Edgar Sawtell. That second book, at 562 pages, might not seem like a light beach read, but the debut novel is poised to be a hit. 1 week after the novel was published, it was already into its 7th printing. NPR's Jeffrey Freimanwire has this story about both novels and how the Prince of Denmark becomes a Midwesterner.
Both authors say they didn't set out to simply update Hamlet. David Robleski is the author of The Story of Edgar Sawtell. He says he wanted to change the rules, feeling more obligated to be original than faithful to Shakespeare.
The exercise became how to subvert that as many ways as I could, to look for white space in Hamlet's story, to look for ways to invert things.
Gone is Elsinore Castle, and the Danish royal family moved to a Wisconsin farm. Perhaps the biggest difference is that Edgar is mute from birth. He communicates with his parents and the dogs they breed and train using sign language. Though there are no soliloquies, Edgar is gifted with words, naming all the dogs after searching through a well-worn dictionary.
Hamlet is hyperverbal. He can talk circles around everyone else around him. And in Edgar's case, I wanted him to be hyper-observant. And I felt that by subtracting the power of language, he would be a more believable and more potent observer of what's going on.
The other new Hamlet-inspired novel is Undiscovered Country by Lynn Enger. He sets his story in the fictional northern Minnesota town of Battle Point. The book begins with what appears to be a hunting accident. Enger says the scene occurred to him more than a decade ago as he was up in a tree deer hunting with his brothers.
I heard a shot and I just had this picture in my mind of a kid, probably 16 years old, sitting in a stand like I was and hearing a shot like that, feeling that something was wrong and getting down out of the tree, running toward the sound of the shot and finding his father dead on the floor of the woods.
The boy, Jesse Mattson, doesn't believe that his father would commit suicide. Enger says it wasn't until he actually wrote down that scene that he realized it mirrored the beginning of Hamlet and decided to use the play as a starting point.
To find out whether my character, given the same dilemma that Hamlet faces, would make similar decisions.
In both of the new novels, there is suspicion, betrayal, and an uncle close at hand to offer help, and more, to his brother's widow. Shakespeare's work has long been adapted and even been set in the American Midwest before. Jane Smiley's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, A Thousand Acres, told the story of King Lear on a farm in Iowa. Author David Robleski based the fictional Sawtelle Farm on his own childhood home. His mother trained dogs on their 90-acre farm in central Wisconsin. He describes his novel as simply a love story between a boy and his dog, and points to Rudyard Kipling's Mowgli stories about a boy living in the wild as another major influence. He explains the book's likeness to Hamlet this way.
I think of the relationship between Edgar's story and Hamlet's story as a refolded piece of origami. At one time, this was a perfectly executed origami crane, and I unfolded it and refolded it into a different shape. And when it's in that different shape, say it's a frog now, you can see a few feathers over here where no frog should have feathers. But it is primarily a frog.
The big themes of Hamlet can withstand a lot of folding and refolding. Author Lynn Enger.
Vengeance versus justice or vengeance versus forgiveness is probably the oldest moral dilemma that human beings face. And I think they can serve as a thematic impulse for stories set in any culture.
Hamlet's story, after all, wasn't new when Shakespeare made it his own.
This is what storytellers do. They take old stories, they change the proportions, they change the elements around in ways that are meaningful to them.
And sometimes that means surrounding the Prince of Denmark with a kennel full of dogs or having him hunt deer from a tree in Minnesota. Jeffrey Fryman Wire, NPR News.
Earlier on the show, Day-to-Day's personal finance guru, Michelle Singletary, talked about good summer reading for saving money. But, you know, regardless of actual content, my favorite title for a personal finance book is The 4-Hour Workweek, Escape 9-to-5, Live Anywhere, and Join the New Rich. Right there, three of my goals done. I spoke earlier with the author, Timothy Ferris. A 4-hour work week, really?
It is possible. The goal isn't to get everyone necessarily to 4 hours, but to reduce workload in most cases by 20, 30, 40%.
Okay, so it's just a catchy title, but you don't really mean literally 4 hours, because I have to say I'm talking to you Tuesday morning. I've already put in 3 weeks worth.
No, you know, I do mean there are case studies in the books that have gone down to 4 hours a week, but if you're a writer or a teacher or a pastor or something like that, the issue is often having too much volume of something you like. So you don't want to necessarily get to 4 hours, but you want to reduce it down to a manageable level. But I have friends, mostly investment bankers, let's say, who actually say, oh, I misread the title of your book. I thought it was the 40-hour work week and I was going to buy it anyway. So I think that the problem for most people is step one, eliminating unpaid overtime and work on the weekends and evenings.
Okay, so how do we do that?
recognizing that in a digital world, there are three types of currencies. There's time, income, and mobility, and time is the most valuable of those three. You can use programs like rescuetime.com, which will tell you exactly where you're spending your time on the computer, whether it's applications, web browsers, et cetera. But you also want to look at what I would call the crutch activities and identify those. So crutch activities are, like email, activities that you use to simulate forward motion without actually accomplishing anything, in most cases, to avoid the important. So most people focus on to-do lists, and they end up essentially having a life run by 10-minute Outlook increments. So you just want to have a short list of not-to-dos. The last, I would say, step that we have probably enough time to cover would be this concept of outsourcing your life.
Okay, so what could I outsource? Let's say, could I outsource? I mean, there are lots of things that I couldn't outsource, right? Like grocery shopping, like taking the kids to piano lessons, like answering all those emails I have to answer.
Think of it more like off-choring. So instead of off-shoring, it would be off-choring, meaning I actually use Craigslist, I would say, Craigslist.org, for probably 40% of the activities that I outsource, because they're local things like getting groceries, picking up dry cleaning, et cetera, and you can find someone to do that. In my personal case, about a week ago, a certain component on my bike broke, and it was about 5 p.m. on a Saturday, and I didn't want to spend the next hour calling different bike shops, so I called Ask Sunday. So if you go to AskSunday.com, you call a New York number and it routes to agents in India. And I said, all right, I need you to call every bike shop within 10 miles of my zip code. Find this part. Once you've found it, have them reserve it. Call me and let me know where it is. That would be a very simple example. Their service, I think it's about, you get 30 requests like that per month for about $60.
So instead of you calling bike shops, spending an hour or so figuring out where to go, you've got someone in India doing it for you while you have a margarita on the porch.
Right, or do whatever it is that you want to do on your weekends as opposed to running errands. I really feel like time is the scarcest currency that people should protect, and they have not learned how to measure it and look at it and use it properly.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Timothy Ferris. He's the author of The 4-Hour Work Week, Escape 9 to 5, Live Anywhere, and Join the New Rich. And by the way, he told me that he did not outsource the writing of that book. He did it all by himself.
Where to go for all things on shipwrecks? Well, that's the theme today for our series, Three Books. Here's Jake Halpern on his three favorite reads about shipwrecks.
Once, just once, I persuaded my wife to go sailing with me. We were in northern Poland, and for just $8, I rented a gorgeous wooden sailboat. It looked as if it had been preserved for decades in a giant glass bottle. "Can you sail it?" inquired my wife. "Dude," I told her, "no problem." This, of course, was a lie. We were barely 50 feet from shore when a howling headwind blew us back against the rocks. We survived, narrowly. Afterwards, my wife quipped that it was almost as if I had wanted to shipwreck us. She may have been right. Ever since I was a kid, I've longed to be a castaway. I memorized facts about the Bermuda Triangle, learned to distinguish between flotsam and jetsam, and watched Gilligan's Island with cult-like devotion. My parents were landlubbers. Their notion of nautical adventure was ordering shrimp scampi at Red Lobster. And so I sailed the high seas in books. My favorite was Daniel Defoe's classic novel, Robinson Crusoe, which reads like nonfiction. There are pages upon pages devoted to the details of how Crusoe raised goats, made pottery, grew corn. Not very sexy, I admit, but that's the point. Crusoe is stranded on this island for 28 mind-numbing years, and his survival depends on his ability to build everything he needs from scratch. The story builds slowly, realistically, drawing us in, and then, by the time the cannibals arrive, you're in a cold sweat. Jan Martel's Life of Pi, a much more recent book, is like Robinson Crusoe on a bad acid trip. The narrator, Pi, is the son of an Indian zookeeper who chooses to relocate both his zoo and his family by ship. The weather turns bad, and Pi ends up in a lifeboat with a hyena, a zebra, an orangutan, and a 450-pound Bengal tiger. Sounds like the setup for a bad joke, right? What ensues, however, is a deadly serious narrative detailing a 227-day journey in which Pi struggles to stay alive. Martel's absurdist nightmare is spellbinding. Shipwrecks, of course, are not always a one-man endeavor. Alfred Lansing's Endurance tells the true story of Ernest Shackleton and his 27 men. After being marooned near Antarctica, they hopscotch across ice floes and brave Arctic waters in lifeboats. The gravest danger, Shackleton soon realizes, is not drowning, but mutiny. Shackleton has a preternatural gift for reading men's minds. He has emotional intelligence of the crusty old sea dog variety, and he deftly keeps his men from losing hope. I suspect that virtually anyone who has ever stepped foot on a boat has wondered, if it sank, could I survive? In other words, am I as resourceful as Crusoe, Pye, or Shackleton? I suppose I flirted with that very question during my own small brush with nautical disaster. But dude, who am I kidding? Some fantasies are best lived out in books.
Jake Halpern is the author of Fame Junkies and Braving Home. If and when he ever does get shipwrecked, he says his first course of action will be to comb the beach for jetsam, that stuff that gets thrown overboard to lighten a ship. He's far less interested in flotsam, that's the wreckage itself. His recommendations for reading about shipwrecks are Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, Life of Pi by Jan Martel, and Endurance by Alfred Lansing.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.